Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist, where your special education questions meet expert answers. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, a certified educational therapist, special educator, and your go-to special ed strategist, here to collaborate with families to access special education services, ignite student potential, and erase learning gaps. Together, we'll unlock the services and support your kiddos' needs to thrive. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Good morning and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast. Today we're diving into the critical topic that affects many of our students, cyberbullying and bullying. We're joined by Chad Rose, an expert in bullying prevention and intervention. So thank you for being here today, Chad.
Yes, thank you for having me.
You bet. Before we dive in, can you share a little known fact about you that it doesn't necessarily relate to what you're doing now that people may not know about you?
Sure. I began my career as a football player and coach. So my previous career was coaching football.
Oh, that's awesome. What did you enjoy about that?
I'm a competitor. So I loved competing, but I also loved the team aspect of it. A lot of the guys I played with are still great friends of mine and were essentially family.
So you're an associate professor at the University of Missouri, and you are the leader of the Education Bullying Prevention Lab there. How did being a football coach kind of lead you into your current role?
I run my team much like I ran my football teams. You know, I still coach. I mean, I have a team of 11 doctoral students and a master student and, you know, any number of undergrads. And so I run it much like I did as I was coaching. But I think a lot of my career stems from what I learned from those that coached me. My college football coach was, or is, the fifth most winningest college football coach in history. And he taught us a lot of things. And some of those things still resonate with me today, like give your best effort and do the right things. And some of those key strategies that you need to succeed are things that I still use today when I'm coaching my team and when I'm teaching my undergraduate classes.
When we hear cyberbullying and we hear bullying, can you set the stage for us in defining both of those terms? And then how do those terms differ on their impact, or do they differ in their impact on our kiddos and teens?
Sure. Bullying is generally defined as an imbalance of physical or emotional power, an intent to cause physical or emotional harm, and the behaviors are repeated or likely to be repeated without intervention. That's generally how bullying is defined. Cyberbullying maps onto that definition, but then there are some nuances that one should consider. The repetition piece, for example, as soon as something is posted online, it's repeated because all of the followers or all the viewers can see what was posted. Intentionality is always there because we have to be intentional on what we post. And so those are the subtle nuances that differentiate the two. But really, the way I view it is cyberbullying is a form of bullying, and it fits within the social constructs of youth. Bullying is a social construct, and engaging in online socialization is part of youth's day-to-day.
If we're talking about the nuances, right, of that, and then we are talking about neurodivergent learners, what are the unique aspects we should consider?
Sure. That's a great question. And one that we've examined quite a lot to try to understand the impact on youth with disabilities or neurodivergent learners on cyberbullying in particular. And we found that it's essentially very similar to what we would think about bullying, because a lot of our focus in terms of interventions when it comes to traditional school-based bullying is grounded in social and communication skill deficits. It's the same on online. There are social rules and norms that people follow in these online contexts. And so our students really should be taught digital citizenship and learning how to interact in a socially appropriate way. And we think about those kids with disabilities who may struggle with social skills in person. There is a likelihood that they may struggle with how they socialize in an online context as well.
Thinking of your research, what are you guys examining as a team, and how is this looking to better support our students when we are on such a digital playing field right now?
Sure, that's a great question. We do a lot of different research studies. I mean, I have a large team. I've grown since this started several years ago, from me and one doc student to me and a team of almost 20. And so we do a lot of different things. Our main agenda falls in three categories. The first one is we work with schools and districts on making sure that their school anti-bullying policy is compliant with state and federal regulations, but also substantive enough to impact the lives of kids. So a lot of times our policies are created and they're created through a compliance lens. What we push schools to do is think deeply about what they're doing in bullying prevention and have that be a focus of their initiatives. The second thing we do is we do a lot of teacher training and professional development, but we've expanded our professional development to go beyond just teachers and thinking about those administrators and those parents and those community members. Because I've long said bullying is not just a school issue, it's a community issue, especially when we think about those rural districts where the school is the heartbeat of the community. And then the last thing that we do is we do skill-based interventions. And what I mean by that is we don't just walk into schools and tell kids bullying is bad, don't do it, because all kids know that. What we do is we really look at bullying through a more critical lens on what those predictive and protective factors are. And a lot of times we find that kids that struggle with social and communication skills are more at risk for bullying involvement. And so our interventions are grounded primarily in social and communication skill acquisition. I'll go through a couple of the newest projects that we have, and this was just released. We have two grants from the Institute of Education Sciences. And what we're doing in one of those grants is we've created a professional development that is online, but it's highly interactive and it has a coaching component for teachers. We're looking at elementary school teachers, and our primary focus is really looking at the complexities of bullying, primarily for those youth who are more at risk, including our students with disabilities. And so our modules extend beyond what bullying is and how to recognize it. That extends into looking at bullying among kids that may struggle with social skills, but how do we teach them those social skills in order to reduce bullying? And then the second grant that we hit is looking at a school-wide social emotional learning curriculum to determine whether or not that school-wide social emotional learning curriculum is good enough to reduce bullying among those that are most at risk. Or do we absolutely need those targeted and individualized supports? Very few have examined this, especially at the elementary level, and that's where we are, my team. I have a team of folks that I'm working with out of the University of North Carolina, Louisiana State University, University of Minnesota, and the University of Florida.
I have so many questions. You're doing phenomenal work. Can we just like go back for a second and talk about the laws and policies?
Yeah.
As an educator, you know, school systems have their policies, but what does that look like on a national level and a state level versus a county level?
Sure. So just so folks are aware, all 50 states and DC have anti-bullying legislation on the books. Some are better than others. Some are incredibly comprehensive and some are not. All 50 states require schools to do something in relation to bullying prevention. From a federal level, we don't have any legislation related to bullying prevention per se. However, we do have a number of our civil rights laws that protect certain subgroups of youth from bullying that is specific to whatever that protected class may be. So if we're talking about students with disabilities, for example, the Rehab Act Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibit discrimination or harassment based on disability. And then we have the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act that really protects kids from being moved from one placement to another without having an individualized education program meeting, even if that is in an attempt to protect the child. So I'll explain that a little bit because that sounded strange. When we think about kids with disabilities, they are supposed to be placed in their least restrictive environment. That least restrictive environment is determined by a committee of individuals that represents the domains in which a student would live in a school, right? So you have the special education teacher, the general education teacher, an administrator, someone to interpret the assessment data, the parent, and in some cases, the child. So they determine the least restrictive environment. If a student with disabilities experiences bullying in a specific environment, we can't just take them out of that environment and place them into a different one without having a meeting with all of those people again. And what we're trying to determine is whether or not their environment has become more restrictive, which necessitates placing them somewhere else, or whether or not we can do something in what was originally determined their least restrictive environment and put supports in place in that environment. Because all students have the right to receive education in their least restrictive environment alongside their peers without disabilities to the maximum extent possible. So that's a little bit about the laws, the state laws, and the federal legislation. 37 states specifically require in their states teacher professional development and training. About half of our states, I think it's 19 of our states, directly reference students with disabilities in their state legislation, most of which defer back to federal civil rights laws. Now, when it starts boiling down to let's say on the ground, what schools are doing, some of our states have provided model policies that the school should follow. They've either provided model policies or recommendations on developing the policies, but not all. And so some schools are left to their own devices on developing their policies. But all of that happens under a backdrop of these legislations that are unfunded mandates. So most of our state level legislation are unfunded mandates. So monitoring the bullying reports and having people and supports in place are somewhat limited in some of the schools that have limited resources. So I think in addition to our policies, our schools really have to think about what types of interventions they're implementing schoolwide.
Yeah, and I'm going to get to that. So as a parent listening, where is the best place for them to look to find out more about the specific policies in, again, their state or district?
So there's a couple of great resources out there. Stopbullying.gov is our federal website that has many, many resources for parents. They also have a landing page on that website that details all state laws and policies. So if I'm a parent and I want to know about what my state says, that's the first place I'm going. Because not only do they provide you with the law itself, they also provide you with a breakdown of what it actually says. It's a very useful tool. There used to be, and I haven't got on this website for a while, but there used to be a website called bullypolice.org. And that website was started by a group of parents. And what they were doing was they were providing an assessment of all state laws that they had a grading rubric, and then they would kind of dissect the law and provide parents with information on what it actually says. But the other thing that schools really should be doing and parents should look out for is schools should be providing parents with, in writing, whether it's on their website or in the student handbook, the policy at the school. And beyond just providing the policy, the schools should be providing parents with resources and information related to how they can make a report. And when they make a report, what would be done once that report is submitted? So, like, for example, in the state of Missouri where I live, we have a our law has this 2 day, 2 day, 10 day rule where people that are informed of a bullying incident have 2 days to make a formal report. The principal or whoever is in charge of their bullying prevention task force or team has 2 days to initiate an initial investigation. And they have 10, a 10 school day or 10 business day window to close that investigation. And so that's kind of the guidance that's provided in Missouri. There are other states that are similar, but that's the only one to my knowledge that provides like a timestamp for each one of those phases.
That's really helpful for a parent as well. So they know that there's a guideline, they know where to start, where to end. And I appreciate you sharing those resources. I want to think about, we parents and educators, we can struggle sometimes distinguishing between like normal conflict and actual instances of cyberbullying and bullying. With that, well, let me ask that part because I do have a follow-up about IEPs and free and appropriate education. So I guess let me just start there. How's that?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, it can be difficult to determine because, and I say this all the time, bullying is grounded in perception, right? Bullying is what one kid thinks is bullying, another kid may not. And that's really where we struggle. And when we start to look at that, I really try to look through the lens of the child who is being victimized because they may not feel comfortable expressing themselves. Let's just use this example. I worked for the Human Growth Foundation and we crafted a book that was a parent resource guide for kids who were had disorders of growth. We did something very similar for kids for the Allergy Foundation for kids that have food allergies. And a lot of times those two sets of youth, and much similar to a number one, number of our other subsets of youth, they experience bullying by people calling them names like Shorty, and or you have a kid that has a peanut allergy and somebody's always bringing, something that has peanuts in it and like acting like they're going to give it to them. And some kids want to fit in so bad socially that they're not going to say anything and they're going to endure it. And then they're just going to bottle that up inside and internalize it. And what we have to do with our children is have an open line of communication as adults, whether you're parents or teachers or administrators, because those things hurt. And what I talk to parents about is in they're trying to figure out whether or not their child is being bullied or bullying others. The first thing I tell them to look for is any marked behavioral change. So has their child change their behavior? Are they becoming more withdrawn, or have they changed their peer groups? Has their eating habits changed, their sleeping habits? And then when it comes to cyberbullying, has their behaviors related to their devices changed? Do they use their devices less, or do they use their devices more? Are they more guarded when you come around to see what they're doing on their devices? And so if that is the first step that we just constantly watch whether or not our children have behavioral changes, we're making a move in the right direction. The second thing I tell all parents is we have to talk to our kids. Like, for example, when I think about when I used to pick my daughter up, she just started eighth grade today, so it's an exciting day for her. But I remember I used to pick her up. And it was around about second grade when I'd pick her up and I would say, "Hey, how was your day?" And she would say, "Fine." And I'm like, "What was fine about it?" Right. But a lot of parents just stop there, drive home, and it's, that's it. What I encourage parents to do is ask direct questions, right? So, what made you laugh today? Who did you play with today at recess? What did you play? Who decided what you played? And all these questions open up a line of communication. Then, once that line of communication is open, children feel more comfortable talking to you about some of the complexities that they experience in school. And it may be that they come to you and say, "Look, this kid just keeps calling me Shorty, and I don't like it, but people laugh, and I kind of fit in trying to figure out how to navigate that." Or some kid keeps bringing a peanut butter sandwich to school every day and sits next to me. "I don't like it, but people laugh, and I feel kind of in the in crowd because people are around." And so kids struggle navigating that. And so it's our responsibility really to talk to them, teach them what to say, what to do, and who to tell. And if they don't feel comfortable with that, then we talk to them about, well, we're going to have a conversation with your school about what they can do. And then I talk to schools about making sure that we maintain, schools maintain an open line of communication with the parents. And we have to start to develop stronger partnerships with our schools as parents. Schools have to also start developing stronger relationships with their parents. And in doing so, we can start to recognize who's involved more rapidly.
How do you encourage parents in schools to develop that mutual partnership?
Yeah, that. So this is a question I get all the time, because I think we're all in a space that's challenging, because we never want to be the helicopter parent. And we also don't want to be that teacher that's sending notices home all the time saying the kid's doing something wrong. So the first thing I tell parents is that the school is going to do the best they can for all the students that they have. I've been in thousands of schools, and and I've met thousands of teachers that are well-intentioned. And sometimes they may miss something. Sometimes their classes may be crowded, but a lot of times they can miss the socialization piece of it, because they're so heavily focused on making sure all of their students get the academic content that they need. And so one thing that I push parents to do is talk to their school, talk to their teachers about establishing a relationship. I know when I go into parent teacher conferences and my child has a challenge, I tell the teacher, I said, look, I want to be in this together. I want to be speaking the same language to my daughter. And I want to know what you're doing here. And I'm happy to tell you what I'm doing at home. And then maybe we can come to an agreement on how we can respond to whatever that challenge may be. And I tell teachers, when they're talking to parents, that parents may get upset because they're sending to them to take care of, for most of the day, the one person in the world that they love more than anything. And that piece right there can invoke emotion. And I mean, sometimes I have to remind myself when I go into schools to calm down. I'm a parent, I'm going in, but I also have to fall back on my academic career and talk, practice what I preach. But it's emotional. And so if teachers can understand that parents are sending the person they love the most in the world, and parents could understand that teachers are going to do everything they can to support their child, but it's best if we have an open line of communication, and it's best if we establish a relationship and a partnership early on, then I think we'll be in a better place.
Yeah, I always say we lead with fear and love in our hearts, right? Yeah. As a parent. Yeah. Can we talk about IEPs just real quick? And we know that in order to make a change there, we need data. Mm-hmm. For changing that, or and whether that's least restrictive, to make sure that we have this free and appropriate education. What type of information do you encourage, whether it's parents or teachers, to collect, so to say, data, so that they can present a case for either a change in placement or a change within the school?
Yeah, so IEP is our individualized for a reason, because, you know, every student is going to be different. I'm an advocate for data. I'm an advocate for collecting as much data as you can, whether that's a running record, whether that's office disciplinary referrals, whether that's, I encourage all my pre-service teachers to take notes at the end of each lesson and reflect on how the lesson went. And then, you know, we have the other pieces to that would be, I encourage schools to make sure they keep track of nurses' visits, because that's a big indicator should a kid need support, how often they go to the office, you know, whether they're asking to go to specific teachers. But one key piece of information that really helps when we're working in schools, if schools adopt a behavioral risk screener, what I encourage all schools to do is at the beginning of the year, do this behavioral risk screener. There are a number of them out there, but essentially what those screeners are doing is they're determining whether or not that child is engaging in the socially appropriate behaviors at an age appropriate rate, right? So we focus on on these behavioral risk screeners because they are early indicators of a number of things, including special education placement. But even if a kid has an IEP, those screeners are key to knowing whether or not there have been growth in specific areas. I encourage all IEP teams to make sure that screener information is included in the present levels form. And if the student ends up in one of the areas on the screener that needs support, like for example, on our screeners, we focus on emotional and social behavior. So that's kind of where I look at in some of our screeners. And if those screeners are hitting as that kid is at risk, then what we'll do is we'll provide that student with targeted support, meaning we may provide them with support in small groups, or if they are really at risk, individualized supports. But all of that information can be included in the IEP. And I think we should be using the IEP as a tool just beyond our traditional academics. And let's say they have a functional behavior assessment, behavior intervention plan. We really should be using that IEP as a tool to recognize how kids are socializing in school as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I always encourage parents or just, professionals, you're thinking bell to bell for educational impact, not only academics, but that education, social, emotional, communication, behavior. And I like that there's this a screener available. Would somebody just Google that, or do you recommend a particular one if either a professional or a family member is looking for this so that they can add that information into whether it's their parent input statement or the present level that a professional is writing?
Yeah, the one that I use the most is called the SABRES. It's the Social Emotional Academic Behavior Rating Scale. And it was created by a friend of mine, Steve Kilgus, a long time ago. And there's really strong psychometrics to it. We use it when we're working in school districts that want to identify kids that are struggling with social and communication skills. And then what we do is those kids that we identify on that screener, and the developers of the screener provide kind of a scoring rubric for you, so you would know who's at risk based on national norms. And then what we do is we pull those students out and provide them with targeted instruction. Many of our schools today are going to models to where they have like a homeroom period or an RTI or a PBIS period. And we really draw upon those periods to provide kids with these targeted supports because during those times, kids are moving everywhere in a school, so it doesn't look out of the ordinary to be providing those supports.
Yeah, and we were talking about earlier just in terms of kids with social and communication needs and to support that risk. So what exactly does that look like? Because informing, right, giving the information, doing the professional development and the training, and then to really kind of wrap that around, what would that look like for a school to integrate into their day? And I love the pockets of time that, yes, you're seeing more and more schools with these little fly times or PBIS or whatever it may be, that then you can target your interventions there and nobody feels like they're being called out for anything or they're not losing their academic instructional time.
Right. I mean, to me, that piece is key first off, because we don't one of the other predictors of bullying involvement is youth appearing dependent on adult support. And when we're going into classrooms and pulling students out randomly, it gives this appearance that they need adult support or extra support. And so if we do it in a way that's seamless in schools, that reduces that risk. You asked a big question because this is what me and some of my colleagues are trying to tackle right now is this hidden curriculum. And these are the social rules and norms that everybody seems to know but aren't directly taught. And the reason we don't teach them is largely due to the focus on academics, on the heels of No Child Left Behind, where we really started focusing on testing and making sure no child was left behind. Even though that's gone away somewhat, we still lean hard into these standardized testings and our academic standards, which I appreciate because I think, I mean, we need to get there as well. But we focus far less on how social our schools are. And this is really where kids learn these critical life skills on how to communicate with others in an effective way. And those skills serve them just as much, if not more, than learning algebra. And I'd argue that all day long. I mean, I've seen people leave high school, never use algebra again, but they have conversations every single day. And so they need to know that. But I think the bigger issue is not just that we lean heavy into academics. The bigger issue is that these social and communication skills are so incredibly complex that we have yet to really sit down, or our teachers rarely sit down and think about how complicated it is to have these social skills. So, for example, asking for help, it's a critical social skill, but some kids don't have it because they may be afraid to ask for help, or they've seen someone ask for help and get ridiculed. And so they try to navigate this area of needing help, but not wanting to appear dependent on adult support and not wanting to look dumb in front of their peers. And so we have to give kids the tools. But I think the most clear depiction of how complicated social skills are is through the use of conversation. Conversations are so complicated, yet I believe they're the building block of all social skills. Kids need to know how to have a conversation, but what happens when we teach it in schools, it's very linear. It's like, you talk, I talk, you talk, I talk. And that is an authoritative way to have a conversation. So you have this conversation with an adult, certainly you want to let them talk, then they will let you talk. But if you have a conversation with your peers, it's really this natural flow of interruption after interruption and tangent after tangent. And that's how our conversations work, yet we never really teach that. But if we think about those kids with autism, for example, if we're only teaching them this linear way of having a conversation, and then they go talk to their peers and they're interrupted, or the conversation takes a tangent, then they really struggle. And so that's when they start to pull back on conversations, because that wasn't how they were taught. It didn't follow what the teacher told them. And so now all of a sudden they're struggling and trying to understand how to interact. And to me, that's why we're not directly teaching social skills in our schools, because they're complicated, and there's not a great curriculum out there to teach the nuances of socialization.
You think about processing memory and attention, right? So if you're in sensory, right, all of this, it gets complex, because if there's any of those elements, and then girls naturally talk faster, and so then you're on a playground, and how do you keep up with that? So you're right. How do you teach that in a way for students to develop that capacity to be able to communicate in a way that is effective in that social setting?
Yeah, I mean, this is getting at some of the curriculum that we have out there now. You know, I've reviewed most of the curriculum, and one of them, and even something that I wrote, one of the pieces in there was like, you know, one of the tips and strategies is like, make friends. Well, that's pretty easy to say, very hard to do, right? It's just telling a kid to go make friends is really complicated, because A, we have to rethink what we're saying to kids about friends and friendship, because I think this is another challenge that we have, especially working with youth with disabilities, is that we overuse this word friend and friendship. You could walk into any number of kindergarten, first, second grade class, and you hear the teacher say, okay, friends, let's all get together. And what that's doing is it's telling our kids that just because we share the same physical space, we have to be friends, when in fact, that's not the case. We force this concept of friendship without teaching the essence of friendship. We force this idea without really starting to unpack it ourselves. And it's okay that our kids aren't friends. They just have to be friendly, right? That's what we want. That's what we're really saying, is that when you're in this space, we have to be friendly to one another. We have to be collegial. We have to work together, because we don't have the capacity to be friends with all of these. We don't have the capacity to be friends with everybody. You know, I say anytime I get a chance to stand up and talk, I'm like, I tell people, you know, I have 1,200 friends on Facebook. But if I got 1,200 text messages on a Friday night, I couldn't handle that. Or I'm rolling in 1,200 deep to my local pub. It's not going to happen. And so we don't have the human capacity to do that, but we do have the human capacity to be friendly to others. And so what we got to start doing is talking to our kids about what friendship actually means and how to find and navigate these social spaces to find our place, because there are places for everyone. And with the advent of social media and with the advent of all of this online gaming, a lot of people are finding friends in electronic spaces as well. And so getting back to your question, I mean, the sensory overload in a school is immeasurable. Like I would encourage any parent to walk out onto a playground during recess and say, hey, you go navigate this. Like, you know, you go find somebody to play with, because it is really hard for kids. And so we need more supervision in these spaces. I think that in some cases, some of these spaces should be more supervised more, but implemented in a more systematic way. Like, we are going to do these things today. We need to think as adults how we're matching our kids together. We need to be modeling the same things that we're asking them to model. And so when we go out into the supervisory space, we should be interacting with them, not interacting with the other adults that are out there. And I think that those are some strategies that we can use to improve those spaces with less structure.
You brought up a good point about online gaming and kiddos meeting friends or meeting others in the online space to game together. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how do you navigate that as a parent? And what is research showing you the results of that?
I'm really excited to talk about this, because this is something that is, to me, is something new that my team has been able to do. So first off, I hear you, parents. Like, I hear you. I have a daughter who is about to turn 14. She's been on social media for a really long time, because, you know, I do have some privilege in that I know how to monitor it, and I know where all the parent resources, and I have contacts, and, you know, so like I recognize that. But my daughter is deep into social media. And when I think about friendship, right? Friendship is not defined by physical space. And one thing that we have to recognize as parents is that kids are socializing in electronic spaces in ways that we never imagined, but also they can't differentiate between electronic and physical spaces the way previous generations have. I mean, I'm generation X, and so we are the last generation to navigate the non-internet world with the internet world. And when I look at how kids are socializing and being so incredibly creative in these online spaces, I would never want to take that away from them. We just have to teach them how to be safe. And we did this study recently, and I'll tell a short story, but my daughter ran up to me one day and she said, "Dad, you got to do something. My friend's talking about hurting themselves." And I'm like, "Oh no, who?" Because I knew all of our friends in physical space. And she's like, "Cool Ninja 2447. And so I had to look at her for a second, and I'm like, you know, I had to take my father hat off and put my researcher hat on and see that she was emotional, like it was one of her friends. And I'm like, "Okay, so tell me about it." And we got that resolved. It was fine. But then a couple of days later, my wife sent me this picture of a plant. She's a plant connoisseur. We have hundreds of plants in my house. And she sent me this picture, and she's like, "Look at this," like all excited. And I responded really indifferently, just, you know, "Cool." And she responded back to me. She said, "All my friends in my plant group love this." And so when she got home that night, I said, "Are you friends with these people?" And she's like, "Yeah." She's like, "I talk to them all the time." And I said, "Okay." So that prompted us to study it. Those two conversations prompted us to determine whether or not kids are actually developing friends online. And I'm happy to report, and I mean, I don't know if everybody's going to be happy about this, but I'm happy to report that a large majority of our middle and high school youth say that they have developed friends online. A large majority of our high school youth have also said that those friends that they have met and developed online are just as meaningful to them as their friends in physical space. Now, I want to say that and then also say, however, we've done that a similar study at the university level, and the students at the university level seem to be pulling back from their online friendships and diving more headfirst into physical types of socialization because their horizon has just been opened up, right? Now they're no longer confined to that one school. They're around thousands of people. And I find this incredibly fascinating because we have kids that are finding a space for themselves online to where they can find people that allow them to be themselves. And that's really what we all want. We all really just want to be individuals. And I think the online spaces allow our kids to do that. And so with that said, we have to do a better job in our homes and our schools on teaching kids, you know, that safety online, but also recognizing that there's choices that they make online, what they post and what they don't post, how they respond or not respond are all choices that are important. And then also teaching them about this concept of permanence. They're starting to develop a digital footprint that will last, that will carry along with them for a number of years. And so as long as we're teaching them those things, then I feel that the online community is becoming a safer place, but that's not to replace parental monitoring. Like, parents should monitor, but you know, I think that our kids are developing friendships online.
What are some resources that parents and professionals can turn to support all of our students, but particularly our vulnerable students?
Yeah. There are a couple of places that you can go. I mentioned stopbullying.gov already. There is the Cyberbullying Prevention Center out of Justin Patchen and Samir Haduja. They run that center, and I believe it's out of Florida Atlantic University. The PACER Center is amazing for youth with disabilities, especially, but the PACER Center offers great resources, but they also have their National Bullying Prevention Center, which is great. There's a center out of the University at Buffalo called the Alberti Center for Bullying Abuse and Prevention. They do a lot of great work, but their director, Amanda Nickerson, is really heavily involved in bystanders education and supporting those bystanders. You can come to our website, the Mizzou Ed Bully Prevention Lab. I mean, I think if you Google that, you'll find it. I don't know the exact web address. I think it's MizzouBullyPreventLab.com. And then one of my good close colleagues out of the University of North Carolina, she has the Rave Lab. Her name's Dorothy Espelage, and she has the Rave Lab, and they have a website. She and I work a lot together. She's on the grants, on both of my grants. They do a lot in the area of school violence and other minoritized youth groups other than kids with disabilities. So I think that's a few resources.
How do we encourage bystanders, right? Like, I think I'm interpreting that correctly, of just somebody that is either on physical or digital space is seeing, oh, this person is acting a certain way towards this person, and I see that they don't like it. So how can we encourage and build those skills for our students and youth so that they can report it or do something so they feel empowered?
Yeah. First off, we have to recognize how hard it is to do that, right? That's the first thing, you know, because this is another time where we go into schools or we're talking to kids and we're like, if you see something, say something. Well, it's hard because there's always that risk. There's always a risk if they say something that it's going to come back to them. So like, just by saying that doesn't solve the problem. What we have to do is teach kids how to report it in a way that protects them. And so our school-based policies have to include, you know, those mechanisms that they would use to keep reports confidential. The other thing we have to do is make sure that schools are providing students with the resources necessary to make those reports. I was in a long time ago, I was in a school and I was talking to them about their bully prevention policy. They walk me to the office. They show me the slips that kids have to fill out if they're making a report. Those slips are bright pink. Who in the world is going to walk into the office and pull that and fill that out? And so, like, we have to be thoughtful in how we're providing kids with the mechanism to make reports. One really cool way that I've started talking to school districts about, and one of my doc students came up with this a couple of years ago, is if you post a QR code on the walls, you post a QR code on the wall, that goes to a digital reporting form, whether you're using Google Forms or Qualtrics or whatever you're using, that would go to a digital reporting form. And kids can make a report. No one thinks anything, especially in a high school or middle school. No one's going to think anything of a kid's, thumbing their phones because they're doing it constantly. And so that's a way that they can make a report, remain relatively anonymous, and not, and nobody's going to know. But we also have to teach our kids what to make reports and about what. Like, what are they going to make the reports for? What are they looking for? And so we have to make sure that we're doing a great job in our schools in providing them with the information, whether that's through routine in services, or maybe we have a space in that RTI period where the teacher is going to talk about what they would do should they see it. But they need to be informed. One thing that I tell all schools is kids need to know what to do, what to say, and who to tell. But adults in the building also need to know their steps in protecting a victim, responding to the alleged bullying, and protecting the reporter. If we're framing our policies based on those six components, then we should be pretty safe.
As we hear about budget cuts and teachers being overwhelmed and teachers covering classes and principals, everybody's trying to do the best. What is something that we could do that really could get this message across? I think those six elements are key. What is something that staff can do that doesn't feel overwhelming or doesn't cost anything or kind of in this space of where educators are feeling now?
Yeah, I'm hearing this all across the country, and I know schools and teachers are feeling pressure. The thing that I talk to schools most about in terms of changing of program is thinking more deeply about that hidden curriculum, as we mentioned earlier, the social rules and norms that everybody seem to know but aren't directly taught, and thinking about how can we directly teach those things? Because the students we're really talking about are the students that struggle with those things. So how can we do that? Without money, with limited resources, without change, without, completely changing everything. And one of the easiest ways that we can do this, and this takes buy-in first off. I mean, we have to believe that we have to do something in a school building in order for anything to get done. So one of the easiest things that I tell all teachers that they can do is when they write their lesson plans, they have learning objectives. In addition to those learning objectives, they can have some sort of social or communication skill objective. Let's just use collaboration, for example. Let's say we have a teacher that has their students broken out into groups. This happens all the time. There should be intentionality behind why you're in groups. There should be learning objectives for why you're in groups. In addition to those learning objectives, we tell our students, these are their learning objectives. Also, I'm going to be looking to see how you collaborate. Collaboration to me means, and you define it. And then when you see kids engaging in collaboration, you walk around and use behavior-specific praise. I really like the way you are, or you should be proud of yourself for. And if we just shift to adding social and communication skills as objectives in our lessons, and we shift our mindset from giving reprimands, corrective feedback, and general praise to really using behavior-specific praise. I really like the way you are doing whatever you're doing, or you should be proud of yourself for doing whatever you're doing. Then we will see a shift in student behavior, the classroom climate, the school culture. That shift will happen. We have decades of research around behavior-specific praise to demonstrate that would happen. But to give you a little context, right now, we as educators are more prone to providing corrective feedback or reprimands. Stop doing that. Sit down. Don't do that. than we are to giving behavior specific praise to a student who is simply doing what you expect them to do. And so it just requires, it doesn't require any money. It just requires a mind shift of a teacher to recognize that if they do in fact use behavior specific praise, those behaviors will shift.
As we wind down today, what is something I didn't know enough to ask that I should have asked?
Oh no, you touched on a lot. Well, we got to quite a bit. The one thing that I think, the one thing that I thought about at one point we were having this conversation, and one thing that I missed is to tell parents of youth with disabilities that they should be advocating for their child when they go into those IEP meetings. It is so incredibly important for you to be informed. It's so incredibly important for you not to just be talked at, but be a contributing partner in that conversation, because that is how the program and education for your child is developed. And it is really important that you have a voice. And more times than not, the papers are already crafted and the special ed teacher is doing most of the talking. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to provide your opinion. Don't be afraid to ask for reasonable accommodations for your child. Be your child's best advocate. That's the strongest tool that you have when you have an IEP, is to go into the IEP meeting informed and having a conversation with the teachers that are there.
Amen. Amen. Final question. If you had a billboard, I think you might have answered this, but it may be different, for parents with one tip, what would it be and why?
Talk to your kids. Talk to them. I mean, talk to them. And if they keep giving you one word responses, ask another question and ask another question until they learn that you're going to ask questions until they have a conversation.
I have three boys and we're working on this in our house. And I always say, this is the hill I'm going to die on. Having conversations is a life important skill.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I am grateful for your time today. I know so many folks are going to glean tons of information, action items for sure, that they can start to implement, whether it's in their home or in their school building. So I certainly appreciate your time.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. It was quite fun.
You bet. All right. Thanks. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.